girls around the world, thank you for tuning in to Truth to You. That's truth2you.org. It's time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, my friend.
G'day to you, too.
1 Samuel chapter 21.
Very exciting stuff.
Verse 1, Yoel, this is how it begins. David came to Nob. Is it Nob or is it Nob?
Well, it's actually, well, it depends, you know, if you're supposed to have a Dagesh or not. So it's we call it Nov in the modern accent, mm-hmm. The Masoretic text accent. It might have been Nob, you're a Nob.
What does it mean? What does Nob mean?
The word Nov, I don't know. The word Nov, I tried to find some explanation of the name Nov. I couldn't find anything. It's just called Nov. Here it's actually referred as Nove, because it has a suffix that indicates the movement towards Nov. So he went Nove. Oh, okay. There's a bit of change in the name because of the suffix. So he went to this place called Nov. It's in the tribe of Benjamin. Presumably the tabernacle was moved there. We don't know if the ark was there, but the tabernacle was moved there.
And there's a priest by the name of Ahimelech.
There's a priest by the name of Ahimelech, who's, I think, he is the grandson or great-grandson of Eli. Mm-hmm. He's the great-grandson of Eli. Mm-hmm. He is... the house of Eli is still functioning as the priest. Mm-hmm. They get replaced by the house of Tzadok later on. The curse that was put upon them only happens in times of King Solomon. It's clear that at least part of the tabernacle is there, because we have a reference here to the table of the showbread, or mm-hmm. the bread of the showbread. Some people, there's a theory that says it might be somewhere in Mount Scopus. There's one place I read that might say it was there. Mm-hmm. Some people say it might be a bit more north than that. But it's in the Jerusalem area, to be more precise. It's very interesting that the tabernacle doesn't travel that far away from its regular locations. You know, it's like maybe half an hour drive away from Shiloh. So mm-hmm. it's half a day walk from Shiloh. Mm-hmm.
So that's Nov, Ahimelech. My brother is king. Is that correct?
Ahimelech, my brother is king. So it's very interesting, this name. It's not theophoric. There's no reference to God, but the word Melech might be a reference, and I dare say this might be a reference to Molech.
Really?
So maybe there is a mixture here of profane with other things. But on the other hand, remember the word Avimelech, for example. Sure. Avimelech, who was the son of
my father is king.
Son of Gidon or Yerubal.
Yes. Yes.
So again, it might be Melech is just a reference to, my brother is important. Maybe that's what it means.
Perhaps. Again. And so David turns up, and Ahimelech was afraid when he met David. And he said to him, why are you alone?
Afraid is not really a right way of describing it. He wasn't afraid. Vayecherad. So Vayecherad is actually a verbal form that actually means that, because it says Vayecherad Ahimelech likrat David. It's not that he sat there and he was fearful. When he realized that David was there, he jumped out of his seat and ran. That's basically the physical response to such a thing, in a fearful way. It's not that he was afraid. His response was a response of a person who has concern.
For example, what's going on? What's going on? Why? Yeah. Why would you be here?
Why are you here? Why are you alone?
And why are you? And no one is.
Response.
And no one is with you. He says. So David said to Ahimelech.
So but by the way, how do I know this? You go to the story of Elisha and the woman, the Shunammite, and it says that Mana Asela Shunammite Halazo, Mana Asela Charadah Gdolah Shecharadalanu. Something like that. I'm paraphrasing the original, and Elisha is referring to this woman who built a little room for him and made sure that he has everything he needs. And he asks Gehazi, his helper, what should we do to this lady who's done all these fearful things for us? No, all these things of caring, responding, reacting to the fact that we're here. Basically, in other words, he's using the word root charad to express the idea of caring in an emphatic way. So again, here, it's not necessarily he was fearful. It's an issue of reacting in an emphatic way for the fact that David suddenly shows up and he's by himself. So yeah. it might be he's also fearful, because this might be the reason for the translation, because he might be thinking, well, David's by himself. Maybe he's coming back from battle and he's the only one surviving. He's the only survivor.
True.
So that might be the reason why fearful might be the translation, but there's no indication that's what happened. And we have places in the Bible where the root charad actually indicates an issue of emphatic care.
Fair enough. So David said to Ahimelech the priest, Now, this is what he says here, Will, and people have said this, pointed this out to me before, and it is true. David just blatantly lies to him. He says to him, the king
has... David lies.
He lies to him. He says, the king has ordered me on some business, and he said to me, do not let anyone know about the business on which I send you or what I have commanded you. I have directed my young men to such and such a place. Now, therefore, what have you got on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand or whatever can be found. And so now he's demanding.
By the way, you're reading very, very fast. Slow down. Okay. It is a short chapter. There are a few things we can touch on. So first of all, yes, he does lie to him, and it's very, very interesting that he does that. But in the situation he's in, his life is in danger. So you know, you would make a white lie or even a blatant lie to survive. You know, if someone tells you, unless someone else will be killed, I can understand what David is saying. But by the way, this is what happens.
There's a question, so because people search out chapter 21 and they say, what's the problem here? Why did this happen? And it has to be asked, a simple question, is David breaking Torah by lying to the priest?
So the problem we have specifically here is he's lying in a point where he receives something which is very questionable, he's allowed to receive it.
True, true. And that's the second thing. We'll get to that in a minute. But is it a problem, you know, as far as the Torah is concerned, that David should tell, as you say, a white lie?
David, we can maybe call this a white lie. I'm not too sure if we can really say it's a white lie, because he's not distorting the truth. He's basically saying, oh, I'm here with the king and king's deeds, and I have people hiding out somewhere, and I'm just here to get provisions because things were we had to go out very, very quickly. Those are lies. So I don't think this can be a white lie, because the definition of a white lie is when you distort some of the truth.
But
it's still based on truth. He is blatantly lying.
So perhaps this may be the first problem. But the second problem is that he says, what have you got on hand? Give me some bread to eat, whatever you can find.
Yeah, so he basically said, no, this is a priestly place, and as a priestly place, people bring gifts. You know, it's not necessarily just sacrifices and stuff like that. It can also be people used to bring their own free will offerings, where they'll decide to give the priests or the Levites a gift just from their own, just to their own free will, nothing to do with tithing or anything like that. And he's saying maybe someone gave them some provisions, you know, maybe some bread, some milk, fruits or something, which has nothing to do with the temple. Because, yeah. You have the tithing, which is a whole subject by itself.
Which we did a program on, and people can find that on Truth to You.
And we also have, you know, first fruits, which is what the priest is supposed to receive. Sure. Tithing, by the way, one of the things we mentioned there is that there are a lot of different opinions about tithing. But one of the very clear things in the Bible is that tithing doesn't really go to the priest, it goes to the Levites. And we don't know yet of a mechanism here of people bringing the tithe to the temple, like it's mentioned in other places. But in any case, it could be that someone brought some gifts or something like that, or maybe someone, you know, came by and gave some loaves of bread or
flour. He's asking for some provision.
He's asking for provision to something that might not be holy. He hasn't asked for anything that's holy or anything.
So
but he's saying maybe there's something there. Then we have an interesting transition here. It says, Vayan ha-ko'enet David, vayomer. And the priest answered David. He's no longer Achimelech, he's now the priest. He's taking now religious authority. And keep on reading the verse.
Very good point. He says that there is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread. If the young men have at least kept themselves from women, and then David answered the priest and said, well, truly women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is, in effect, common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day. What is all that?
Oh, wow. Your English translation puts in words there that do not exist in the Hebrew.
Yeah, I know. I've got a lot of italics in there.
Wow. Your English translation is really, really, really trying to squeeze some possible answer what happened here. Well, it is a bit of an obscure verse in Hebrew, but your translation is just completely off. And if your English translation says that, just scratch that one out.
Okay.
So it says the priest actually said to them, we don't have any regular bread. Lechem chol, the word chol. Very interesting, the word chol, chulin, is probably borrowed from Aramaic. So chol means regular bread, everyday regular bread, underneath my hand. So he says, He says to him in verse 4, what do you have underneath your hands? So he's saying, oh, you can see loaves of bread. So by the way, that gives a bit of an indication how big the bread of the showbread was. Because if you go to the rabbinic sources, these things were huge.
Mm-hmm.
Just huge. Go to the Temple Institute images, look for pictures of the Table of Showbread, and they had these huge loaves of bread. And the Temple Institute, a lot of mistakes, but there are a few places where they make a point.
When you say huge, do you mean like a regular loaf of bread, or I mean, what are we talking
about? Much, much bigger.
Really? Like, give us an idea.
I don't know. We're talking about something that might have been, it's a big thing you have to hold up with both hands. But here he's carrying like five loaves. So first of all, the shape of the loaves. In the rabbinic sources, the loaves had a funny shape. They looked like they were bended over in a certain way with like knobs at the ends. The best thing you can do is go to type in showbread or something, and you'll probably find images from the Temple Institute or some other places that give you an idea what the showbread looked like in the rabbinic sources. Very big with a funny shape. The Christian sources, on the other hand, do a much, much better job on this one, where they just describe them as, like, for example, as round cakes or something. And, if he's carrying five of them, so, it's reasonable he's carrying, Shnei Sronim, not that heavy, and it's, you can carry five of those underneath your hand or grab them in your hand and walk. So he has that. He says it. He has lechem kodesh, the opposite. Lechem chol, lechem kodesh. The word lechem, by the way, we mentioned this, bet lechem, bread. In the Bible, lechem always means bread. And he says to him, I can give it to you, but if the young men are pure, if they were careful from being with a woman.
Now, what is he based on?
You have to ask yourself, why does he ask woman? Why specifically woman?
Where does that come from?
So first of all, there's several things. A woman, first of all, we're talking about sexual relation.
Mm-hmm.
And man who ejaculates becomes unclean. Mm-hmm. Also, women have their periods. So women who sit on chairs, anything that they sit on or even in certain situations touch becomes unclean as well. So basically, women are, and I'm not saying this to be insulting to anything, but according to the Bible, women are a more serious source of impurity. And there's types of uncleanliness that can last for 7 days. A man who lays with a woman who's menstruating, a man who lays with a woman who menstruates can be unclean for 7 days. If he sits on her bed or her chair or any designated place,
that's 7 days. And we did a program on that just for the listeners. There's programs on the law of Nidah in Leviticus 15. But so that's 7 days. The other one is 1 day because you become clean. That's right. The only thing I can think of is Mount Sinai.
Yeah, exactly. I was about to get to that.
Okay.
That we do have this thing in Mount Sinai that if you want to approach the holy, you have to prepare yourself 3 days in advance or 2 days, and then on the third day you can approach the holy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another question here. The bread on the showbread is considered to be a holy, or maybe even a holy of holies. Let's actually go look at it in its sources. Let's go a second to Exodus 25.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if it gives us a definition. Because if it's Kodesh or Kodesh Kodeshim, we're dealing with two separate things. The difference between Kodesh, holy, and holy of holies, that would be a very, very important issue of distinction between the two types. So let's go for a second to 25. Mm-hmm. 25. Where's the table?
Just incidentally, we have Exodus 19 in regards to the 3 days. But so 25 in regards
25,
to bread.
25 doesn't help us. Let's go to Leviticus 24. Leviticus would be a more reasonable source to dealing with the level, what the bread actually is. Uh-huh. It also gives a description of what the bread is. And it's a gift to the priests.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, it says in verse 9, ואכלוהו במקום קדוש כי קודש קודשים לו מאישה אדוני חוק עולם. It's basically a holy of holies type of bread because it's inside the sanctuary and it has to be eaten in a holy place. So we have multiple problems here. Problem number one, this is bread that's supposed to be only eaten by the priests.
Yes.
Problem number two, it's supposed to be eaten in a holy place, which is usually another reference to the site of the tabernacle.
Mm-hmm.
So we have two problems here. How does he give it to David? What on earth goes through his mind that he can give this to David? So there are several attempts to explain this, but my ultimate answer is he was not supposed to do this, and they were punished for it. And this is why they were killed, because they embezzled.
Yes, I have to agree with you.
It's their job as priests. Levites are supposed to protect the encampment. The priests, their job is to protect the Holy of Holies, to protect the holy. They're supposed to protect the directly protect the sanctuary and what's in it. Mm-hmm. And they say that this, and there's an opinion that says that they were punished for this. Mm-hmm. And the other side of it also is that David takes the blame. He says, I knew that Doeg was there. They present this. It was all balanced out. It could have been that they would not have been killed if he wouldn't given him the bread, but he gave him the bread and he ran away because giving the bread was also a symbol that he's helping out David. If I, for example, am someone's enemy and I just speak with someone and their enemy see, and my enemy sees that and goes, why do you speak with him? It doesn't mean he'll necessarily kill him. Here, by giving him the bread, he's helping him out. It's a clear help. Mm-hmm. So it's clear that he's aligning with David. So again, this is behind the scenes. And David says, it's my fault because I knew Doeg was there. He mentioned this later on when he talks to Eviatar, the son of Achimelech. And so David realizes it's his mistake, but he sees it from a different point. He looks at it from the point that I knew Doeg was there and I put you in danger because your father helped me out. But you can also look at it from the spiritual point. Yes, we know you have a lot to say.
Yonatan, Prince Halevi IV.
But on the other hand, there's also the spiritual side, basically what's called dual causality or a double reason for something mm-hmm. to happen. Mm-hmm. That first of all, there's a reason for the house of Eli to be destroyed. And also we have the fact that something was done that would be the reason that they get killed, and giving the bread is a reason for Saul to kill them, but it's also a reason for God to kill the priests of Nov because they gave something.
That's right. And this is the question: is why did not Jehovah save the family of the priests? Why, you know, why has it turned out this way? Now we are speculating, but it has to be pointed out that he has Ahimelech has given David something that doesn't belong to David and should not be eaten outside of the holy place, and certainly not eaten by someone outside of the family of the priest. And so this is problematic, it's very, very serious. Yeah,
I will mention that there's, for example, one interpretation says that, oh, the moment it's removed from the table and it's not a sacrifice, it's the possession of the priest and he has the right to do with it whatever he wants. But even the soul, even for example, the ones that say such things about the sacrifices or tithing or anything, say, but it's the right of the priest to give it to other priests. They don't say it's the right of the priest to give it to anyone he likes, and specifically not someone who's not a Kohen. And someone actually asked me, there was a question on Hebrew in Israel, someone asked about what do you do with, can a Kohen be someone who is not from the descent of the house of Aaron? The answer clearly is no. Mm-hmm. So this is why you have to be very careful. You have these people, for example, run around saying they're a Kohen, they're a Levite, what do you mean you're a Kohen and Levite? 10 minutes ago, you were just some schmo from the street. Now you're a Kohen or a Levite? You said you'd be very, very careful with this. I've heard of people doing this lately, and you know you have to have
rampant in the Messianic world. I mean, it really is, people are popping up all over the place who are Kohens and Levites that have barely any substantial proof of such a thing.
Yeah, I mean, for example, most Levites and Kohens. In the Jewish world, they have a lineage, they have a genealogy, or to some degree, and everything. And it's also the practices that you're written down in the rabbinate, wherever your family was around the world, and later on in the rabbinate here in Israel, or the rabbinate wherever you live around the world, even today, that it mentions if you're a Kohen, you're a Levite, whatever. And my family has very clear; it's very clear in many, many places, and we've looked into this and. Almost all the members of the family from my grandfather's side, from the male side of the family, all have a knowledge that we're Levites and we're written down as Levites. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And any Cohen that I know, you can't just walk in and say, I want to change my family name to Cohen or Levi.
No.
You have to have proof of this. When I went in and I requested that my official family name will be Halevi, I went in and they requested a letter from the rabbi.
Yeah, really.
And the rabbi looked at me and said, "What? I've never heard of this." But he said, "Oh, it's the first time. I also have someone who actually officially changes his family name to just be that." So he said, "Okay." So he gave me a letter, but he giggled and he said, "I've never seen anything like this before." But for example, there's a law here in Israel: you cannot walk in to the Interior Ministry and actually ask to change your family into Cohen because it has implications.
It does. And look, that's a fair thing. It's a fair thing because we see the seriousness of it, and we've mentioned this before, in Ezra chapter 2, where it talks about You know, if you don't have a clear connection to your family line, then you cannot assume the responsibilities of a Kohen or a Levite, so on and so forth. And we read about that there.
But, and I also mean people that they have some vague memory that their grandmother said something that doesn't help. It doesn't help. You have to have hard proof to prove this.
Mm.
You know, when I walk around and say I'm a Levite, I have proof. Mm. I have documents from different places that carry the name Halevi.
Mm.
But, you know, most people here in Israel, if you walk around, if they're called Kohen or Levi, no one asks any questions. But these are family names. Some of these people are carrying these family names for thousands and 1,500 years. My family has been carrying the name Halevi for centuries.
Mm. Mm.
It's before people actually had family names, they were just titled based on what they were, and Halevi was one of them.
Sure.
And there are some family names which are recognized as being Levites as well. There's, you know, Levine, for example, is recognized as being a Levite family name. But then you also have, like, for example, I've met women who said, "Oh, my grandmother's family name was Levi, so maybe I'm a Levite as well." I'm like, no, it doesn't work. That goes through the men.
Mm.
I've heard this, people running around living as a Levite, and it doesn't work like that. It's a blood line. It's literally a bloodline. And so it's to be very, very clear about this.
And so that's a very serious thing. As much as that which
and
is
you see, and you see from the story, if you're not entitled to this, there's a good chance God will punish you.
No, and it makes you wonder why David doesn't know. David ought to be saying, "Well, that's not mine. I can't take that." But he doesn't do that. He takes it in any case. Now, the other thing, Yoel, is the theory that you hear a lot that says, "Well, you know, if you're at the point of starvation, then it's okay to break the Torah because you have to eat something and so on and so forth." But I mean, do we limit God to say that He's anointed David to be king and now He's going to let him rot in the desert, or if He had not taken the Kodesh Lechem? Lechem
Kodesh. No.
Lechem Kodesh.
The adjective shows up after the noun. It's the opposite of English.
Opposite of English. If he hadn't taken it, surely God would have provided for him. But we don't get to see that, and we don't get to see how that would have happened.
So there you're asking a very good question. What do you do if you're in the point of starvation? The only thing you have is a tithe or whatever it is. So by the way, it does mention in the Torah that if you eat by mistake, tithe or something, then you just pay it back to the temple. So if you're in a point of starvation, the only thing you have is a piece of fruit or vegetable, something which is from tithe, or not even tithe, but from, for example, first fruits or something. Again, is it worth dying? Does the Torah punish you for this? Again, there must be a way of repenting for such a thing. But here, it's not just David finding the loaves of bread and not knowing what they were. Here, it's the Kohen knowingly. Not a point of starvation, but a point of need provisions. Knowingly gives it to David. So it's not just David, it's also the Kohen. So actually, David is not inflicted for any of this.
Mm-hmm.
He's not punished for any of this. He just takes it very personally and takes it very hard that this happened, but we don't see any punishment for this. No. At least not that we can see in the text.
So, you know, perhaps he didn't know. But surely the priest should have known. In any case,
so there are people who come up with this claim because there's this source that says that David never read the Torah and knew absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But this he never knew the Torah until something about the Ark. Someone once posted this on Hebrew in Israel, and I remember this from years ago from studying this. And there's this idea that David knew nothing. But look, the fact remains that he knows the issues of cleanliness, which means he knows the laws of Leviticus. He, in another place, knows the laws of Numbers, where he mentions how much you have to pay if you steal a sheep.
Mm-hmm.
So David does have knowledge of the Torah, so I have to reject that one.
Sure. Okay. Now we're dealing, incidentally, we're dealing with two, is it fair to say we're dealing with two Mashiachs here? We're dealing with two anointed. We're dealing with the priest.
The Bible the Bible, and specifically the book of Haggai? No, it's not the book of Haggai. One of the smaller prophets, he mentions that they're Zechariah. He mentions the two sons of Yitzhar.
Yeah.
The two sons of the prior oil, which are basically two anointed people.
Mm.
And that's probably the king and the high priest, because these are two characters which are anointed.
So true. So true.
So actually, the Bible actually has technically two messiahs.
That's right.
There's the Messiah who's the king, and the Messiah who's the high priest.
Yes. And here, both of them are falling into this problem. So he does give to David the bread, and off they go. And a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before Yehovah, and his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul. And David said to Ahimelech...
By the way, the English translations have a lot of weird things. The head of the runners, there's a whole bunch of stuff there that... different opinions of what it actually means. So first of all, the reason, if your translation says head of runners, first of all, that's an academic translation. The reason you have that is because someone decided to correct the Hebrew, because it says actually in the Hebrew, it says abir haroim. So first of all, the word abir, in modern Hebrew means a knight, but abir means a mighty one. And he's the mighty one of the herds. He might be the head shepherd or the one in charge of the herds the king had. Specifically, I remember that King Saul actually had herds because that's what his family were doing. Sure. He had herds of cattle. Yep. So it's a ro'im. So it could be cattle. It could be sheep. It could be anything. And also, you know, kings had ministers for different things. You know, Pharaoh had a minister, a cupbearer, which was a whole position by itself as well, but a head baker. By the way, you have to ask yourself a question. Why he had a head baker? Apparently, the Egyptians had dozens of types of baked goods. There's actually a list somewhere. One of the tombs they discovered a massive list of like 70 odd types of bread,
really,
and 30 odd types of sweet cakes.
You're very kidding! I didn't know that. You're kidding.
I am very serious.
So the Egyptians had patisseries and bakeries.
The Egyptians were very big on patisseries.
Did they have
this
coffee?
This is why they had.
No, did they have coffee? Did the Egyptians have coffee?
No, coffee was discovered later on in Sumatra.
What did they have with all their sweetbreads and everything? What
beer?
Beer.
Beer?
Ah, that doesn't work. You don't go to the cafe and order like a with a beer. Are you kidding?
Yeah, you have your honey cake with a glass of honey beer,
and it would have been warm too.
Yeah, probably. But in any case, it's called Bir Haroim, so there's an ayin there. But in the form ayin and tzadi are slightly similar.
Mm-hmm.
If you play around with them, they could look the same. Mm-hmm. So maybe one of these scholars said, oh, there's a typo here. There's a spelling mistake. It should be a tzadi. But the reason they do this is also they jump to the next chapter. They go to chapter 22, and they mention that Saul turns around to the Ratzim. And the Ratzim are the runners. Now, the Ratzim were probably forerunners, people that ran before his mm-hmm. chariot or before his horse to make way. So he turns around to his bodyguards and tells them, kill them. But it doesn't say that there's a connection between Doeg and the runners. There's no connection between them. And he's in no connection.
That's
so he's called, he's probably the chief of the herdsmen. He's an Edomite, by the way, which is very interesting. Why on earth does Saul have an Edomite working for him? And by the way, the Midrash says that he did not convert to Judaism. He never did convert or anything. He was still an Edomite. Mm-hmm. But the Torah says you're not supposed to hate an Edomite because an Edomite was your brother. So having them around wasn't something forbidden, to be clear. But why would an Edomite be the head of the herds is a very, very good question, because we know the Moabites were very good with herds. But he was the head of the herds, and people say that he never converted, or he did somewhat accept the God of Israel, but they say that his cruelty came from the fact that he was an in-betweener. He never really accepted the God of Israel. So he had no remorse over certain things. He didn't really learn the laws of the Torah and had difficulty realizing that these are the priests of God. You don't do that. And this is why he was a very good candidate for doing this, because the runners were like, no, we're not doing this. And he was like, "Oh, yeah, I'll do it." He was probably a mercenary more than anything else. Some people say that he was a head executioner more than anything else.
Next chapter, I think we're probably going to have a short conversation regarding Herod as well, because there's a few similarities there. But it says that he was there and he was taking notes. Doeg the Edomite, and David said to Ahimelech,
"Oh, wait, we're going ahead. I forgot to explain something about verse 6. The problem is with verse 6 and 7.
Go on."
So David answers, I have to go back for a second. David answers and says to the Kohen, he said to him, there is no woman staying with us for the past two or three days. When I left, this is what the translation would be, when I left, all the vessels of my servants were holy, and that is our way in every day. Basically, the thing is that a camp that's in a war camp, if you go back to Deuteronomy 23, it mentions that if a man, for example, has at night, he has the known thing that can happen, then probably people are giggling. He's not saying what it is. The known thing that can happen, he becomes unclean. He has to leave the camp. So a camp of war has to be pure, has to be prepared for the presence of God. So he's not telling him that the bread is profane. That's something that you're in translation put in there to try to explain how the bread is allowed to be eaten. But really what he's saying, because you see, he's emphasizing it's holy bread. This is holy bread. So why would he say to them, oh, the bread is not holy?
Mm.
No, he keeps on emphasizing the fact that it's holy bread. So the point here is that he's telling him our way, when we go in the camp, we're always anyhow, our vessels and everything we wear and ourselves, we're all clean. We're all holy. This is our way in everyday life when we go out as a camp.
So let me just read that, because you brought up Deuteronomy 23. I'm going to go from verse 7. It says, you shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. You shall not abhor an Egyptian, because you were an alien in his land. The children of the third generation born to them may enter the assembly of Jehovah. When the army goes out against your enemies, then keep yourself from every wicked thing. If there is any man among you who has become unclean by some occurrence in the night, then he shall go outside the camp. He shall not come inside the camp. But if it shall be when evening comes that he shall wash with water when the sun is set, then he may come in the camp. It goes on to say, and you've spoken about before, that even when you were in the army, you got to fulfill this part of the Torah as well. You shall have a place outside the camp where you may go out, and you shall have an implement among your equipment. And when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and turn over your refuse. For Jehovah your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and give your enemies over to you. Therefore, your camp shall be holy, that he may see no unclean thing among you and turn away from you. So, again, the importance of holiness and the situation in regards to the camp, and also the Edomite, three things that you were talking about, is nicely highlighted there in chapter 23 of Deuteronomy. But we go on, because
it says in verse 7, it says, Vaitenu HaKohen Kodesh. Yeah, the verse clearly states that he gave him holy bread. So your English translation has to be changed.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, what have I got? Hang on. So I've got...
Your English translation says that the bread is profane.
Really?
That's what I heard. I mean, maybe there's some distortion, but that's what I heard.
So David answered the priest and said, truly women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day.
That translation is terrible.
So the priest gave him holy bread, and there was no bread there but the showbread, which had been taken out from before Jehovah in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away.
So by the way, there's a legend that says that the bread never went cold. It was always warm. It was always warm and fresh.
That'd be nice.
It was one of the miracles that happened in the temple.
Yeah, I'd like to think so, because otherwise it was a week old bread.
Yeah.
Anyway, so David...
Now we can go back to Doeg. Sorry about that.
No, we're done with Doeg. I want to talk about this. It says, David said to Ahimelech, is there not here on hand a spear or a sword? For I didn't bring it with me, because I had to leave really quickly. So the priest said, well, there's the sword of Goliath. There's the sword of Goliath, the Philistine whom you killed in the Valley of Elah. There it is. Now, it's wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. What's that about?
So first of all, we have another reference that mentions that David killed Goliath. So we can assume that the writer of the book of Samuel knew that David really killed Goliath, and what we have in the end of the book is a mistake. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It says he turns around to his Achimelech, but he's answering as a Kohen. And he's probably answering as a Kohen because he's now dealing with some ritualistic items, which is specifically the ephod. So there's a question, is this the ephod that's mentioned as part of the priestly vestments? Mm-hmm. And the answer is probably yes.
Mm.
And one of the ideas that I heard was that it could be that the ephod, being a very, very important vessel, wasn't pranced around by the high priest all the time. The high priest would walk around with regular clothing, mm-hmm. and only when he had to actually function as a high priest, mm-hmm. then he would actually wear the full vestments and everything. So it's possible that what they had, because the ephod was an oracle of sorts, what they had as a symbol, the presence of God, maybe the ark wasn't there, so they had the ephod hanging from the wall or hanging from a mannequin or something. And behind that mannequin or behind that wall, there was also a wrapped sword. And so now they hid it behind it.
Because it was...
And it's, now, it's not unusual for items like that to be taken as trophies.
Because trophies were a sign of the victory of the god. It was something physical we can actually display. Look, it happened. You know, we have to ask ourselves a very simple question. You know, why do we even need a temple? I actually once spoke with a guy who did a bit of a research on the issue of... gods and temples and everything. And specifically, people came from the desert. And he claimed that there was a certain group of Amorites who used to live in the desert, and they had no temple. They just prayed out into the open space. And I never really found any record of this, but he's a pretty reliable person. And he fiercely claimed that this actually existed. And the problem with this group is they vanished very, very quickly because they... had nothing tangible to cling to. So, for example, why do you actually need a temple? Why would one need a tangible place to go to? It's because we're human. So, mm-hmm. for example, for many of us, you know, we need to feel, we need to know in a physical way that God is with us. And one of the ways you do that is you also keep trophies. You take Goliath's sword, big sword. You know, it's you can't lie about whose sword it was because it's a Philistine sword. It's a very big one as well. You know, if you remember the Goliath's description there of his weapons was pretty massive and heavy. So we no doubts about it. And there's also questions like how would David lift such a thing? How would he use it? Unless this was one of Goliath's smaller swords. You have to remember there's regular swords, there's executioner swords, but swords back then were not very big. You know,
comes to mind though when you talk about, because it was a Philistine sword. We know that earlier on, I think in Judges, we were reading how the Israelites had to go to the Philistines to have their farming equipment sharpened, but they didn't have swords. Swords and spears were not among the common men. So what we're to understand is certainly that the Philistines were advanced in metalwork.
Yeah, probably advanced in metalwork. I mean, again. The thing is that we're still dealing with something which probably was the Bronze Age, mm-hmm. that even if a person would have had a sword, this sword was probably made out of bronze, which meant it broke very easily, specifically if he tries to fight someone with iron sword. So yeah, they were probably a lot more advanced. Also, it took time. It's a very interesting thing when it comes to archaeology that they discovered that the people who lived in the mountain area, which is mostly where the Judeans, most of the Israelites were, this is where they felt safe, which is very interesting because today the majority of Jews live more in the coastal area, more in the Galilee, which is, by the way, where I'm moving next week, maybe the time this comes out, I'll already be there. I think by the time this one comes out, I'll already be living there for at least 1 week.
Yes.
The issue is that up here in the mountains, and I'm living at the moment in the mountains of Judea, they discovered that it took longer for things to arrive. Now, if I remember, Saul, David, they're all living in the mountain area, so weapons, iron weapons and stuff like that probably took longer for them to arrive here, which, by the way, creates a bit of a issue with dating where you would think that one date would fit here and then the other date would fit there based, for example, on clay. Clay pots and stuff, and it doesn't really always work out. I mean, again, I'm not an archaeologist. You have to really speak to an archaeologist to get all the details about these things. But I've read quite a few articles and a couple of books on this subject, and even the ones which are not very pro-Bible still admitted to the fact that there's a problem with chronology when it comes to the issue of placing pottery and the advancement of technology of the time in between the coastal plain and the mountains. But in any case, taking a trophy, like a sword, specifically a sword like that, where people know this is a sword of Goliath, is a very, very important thing. And we also have to remember, we brought this up already in the past. Today we live in a place, in a world where we're trying to understand the Bible through Western eyes. But these were Easterners, which means they were more violent, more, I would say, more...
They knew the ways of war. And again, yeah, going back to our discussion in regards to Judges, it says, Yehovah says, you know, that you didn't get rid of these people. Now I'm going to leave them here to be a thorn in your side, irritants in your eyes, so that you may know the ways of war.
Exactly. But one of the things I really want to point out, this is something I'm trying to break in people's mind, is that they were not as majestic as you would think. You know, a lot of people have in their minds these characters running around in robes and, you know, looking very pretty. People smelled.
Isn't that the artwork? The artwork does that to us, right?
I mean, people smelled. People were not very clean. You know, only if you were rich, you had the ability to really keep yourself clean and nice and tidy. You know, it was most people were farmers, and this was a society. You know, that if someone gets on your nerves, you pull up a knife and stab them. Okay, what I'm trying to do here specifically is to try to pull people down from that pink cloud they're on when they read the Bible, because we're dealing with the Book of Samuel, one of the most violent books in the Bible.
It's a violent book in the Bible. Let's just say that it was very, very far from politically correct as far as we understand that term today.
Exactly.
But So basically
the masters and even the leaders, they needed things that they can recognize as being the symbol of God's presence. You know, these were not the very spiritual la la land type of people that we have today.
Mm.
No, they weren't into the whole thing of it was different, basically. I don't really know how to put these in words. If I was speaking Hebrew, it would probably be easier. I'll have more words to actually describe this. But it was not what people think it is. And because you have to raise questions about, you know, David's behavior in different places. Why did he lie? Why is he taking a? Why is he even taking a weapon? Why does he just trust in God? What happens with him in Bathsheba, which when we get to there, we'll explain this as well. You know, why is he so human, and why is he more like us than what we would think he is? He's not this superhuman, because he wasn't, and no one was.
You just raised a question that I hadn't even considered. Why does he need a weapon? Why does he feel the need to obtain a weapon? Why doesn't he just trust in God? I hadn't even thought about that. But I think there's something in that, and I don't know that we have time to get into that now. But I'll say
in a couple words, because they lived in a world very similar to ours. Miracles did not happen left, right, and center.
Mm.
It wasn't people, even in the Second Temple period, people thought that when people were walking around with miracles flying out of their ears and nostrils, it didn't happen. It wasn't like that.
Because Yoel, there's a certain expectation of skill and responsibility and that Yehovah seems to expect from us. And even David acknowledges that. In the Psalms, he says, you know, if I forget Jerusalem, may I forget the skill of my right hand.
Well, it doesn't say skill in the Hebrew. It says tishakach yemini, which means my strength will be lost, because yemin is a representation of the arm, and the arm is a representation of strength. But the point is that they were living in a natural world like we all live in today. They walk around the mountains like we will do today. If I walk around up the hill near where I live at the moment and walk around, it's exactly the same way they would walk around as well. It's just they live in a natural world. Miracles don't happen left, right, and center. And David knew that there's a certain level of he has to do from his own end as well. If miracles were as common as, for example, as natural events, they wouldn't be called miracles. In Hebrew, the word for miracle is nes. And another way the word nes is used in Hebrew is a pillar or a flag or a pole. And in many cases, in places where it's very, very visible. So in other words, when we deal with the word nes or the word miracle, we're dealing with something which is abnormal, something which sticks out.
Mm-hmm.
And if miracles were happening left, right, and center, they would never really be considered to be miracles. It would just be, oh, that's normal, you know, we're used to that happening. But that's the thing. So, for example, when they're in the desert and they were receiving manna every day, after a while there and they get used to it, they forget it's a miracle and they start thinking,
they take it for granted.
They take it for granted. They think it's a normal thing that happens. So this is why David basically goes and he's trying to survive. He takes bread, which he's not supposed to take. We've established that. Mm-hmm. And he takes a sword. Now, also what happens here specifically is because it's very interesting that a Kohen is dealing with a Kohen is the one who actually goes in, and the sword is kept in a place that probably only a Kohen is allowed to go to. And he pulls out this sword, and it's hiding behind the ephod, which is the whole thing is strange. Why is it behind the ephod? But the fact it's behind the ephod comes into play later on. We'll get to that. And he gives it to David, and David basically is very glad we see. He says to him, there's no other sword like this.
There's no other sword like it. Give it to me. That's what he says. But this is my point. I just wanted to establish it's likely that it is a trophy in the tabernacle rather than an idol, like we see, for example, the serpent on the pole becomes an idol.
Yeah. I don't think it was an idol or anything. I think the ephod here...
The sword is a trophy.
The sword is a trophy. I was also thinking about the fact that there are some commentators try to claim that the ephod mentioned here was an idol or something, but there's no real proof of that. Also, what it seems as well, when we see this later on, it seems that there's several ephodim now. They made multiple amounts of these garments to ask God, which is very, very interesting. You know, you would think that only the high priest had one, but mm-hmm. it seems that several people had them. And it seems that it might be that they expanded on the job of a Kohen, or the position of the Kohanim, to basically allow all Kohanim to actually ask in the ephod. And again, is this the asking in the Urim and Tumim? Not too sure. There's a place where it mentions that Saul wasn't answered anymore by God in different places, in dreams, in the Urim and Tumim and everything. So what exactly, we've touched on this before, what exactly is this way of asking in the ephod? Because the difference between ephod and a choshen, the choshen was the actual breastplate. So there's a few obscurities here that I don't really have a clear answer on. But what it seems is that there were several of them, and Kohanim received probably more of what we would think a Kohen or a priest in the ancient Near East was like, that they used to receive oracles and everything, and it was expanded. So we're seeing some kind of an influence, maybe a pagan influence on the Israelites of the time, where they did things inside the circle of Torah, but they changed it a little to fit more what they were dealing with around them. So it wasn't just a high priest and he had the high priest clothing. They took the element of the ephod, which was a way of asking questions to God, and expanded and then had several of them in the land. So in any major locale, there will be a Kohen who can ask God. But it wasn't seen as something forbidden. So really, at the time, there were several things which were done which were probably not really 100% how we would say kosher.
Okay, fair enough. So that's the situation there. It goes on to say, it says in verse 10, then David arose and fled that day from before Shaul. He went to Achish, to the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish said to him, is this not David, the king of the land? Didn't they sing? I mean, they knew about this song, Yoel. They knew about the song that they used to sing. They used to dance. Shaul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. This is a song that they knew.
He was basically famous. So there's a few questions here that we have to ask. First of all, the word name Achish, by the way, does appear in some sources. It's attested in a Philistine royal name. There's a few Assyrian records that from the 7th century that lists a name Akishu or Kisu, son of Padi.
Oh, really?
And he was the king of Ekron. So it's against a Philistine name. There's also some inscription, an Egyptian inscription from the 18th dynasty that connects the name Achish to some name from a person from Troy, which would be very interesting because these Philistines are actually descendants of the Greeks. These are Greeks that traveled over the sea to this area to live a new life. So this name will be accurate. This is a name that is attested in at least two places as being a Philistine name, and specifically one of them also attests that it's a royal name.
I was just going to say, I've got some cross references here in my New King James Study Bible. It says Achish is referred to as Abimelech, which was apparently a dynastic title used by the Philistine rulers, and then it references Genesis 20, verse 2, 26.
The Philistines of Abraham and the Philistines of David are probably not the same groups.
Uh-huh. Okay, we've spoken about that before, haven't we?
Yeah, no, the majority of the opinions that these were the Philistines of they were called, they took the name Philistines probably from the original inhabitants that they conquered mm-hmm. when they arrived there. But the majority opinion is that the Philistines of Abraham and the Philistines of David are two different groups. Right. The Philistines of Abraham were actual Canaanites who spoke Canaanite dialect, where they were Semitic. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, the Philistines of David were Indo-Europeans, came from Greece, a completely different group.
There it is. So in any case, they had heard this song. They knew of the fame of David and primarily because of the...
Question, why does he even go there?
I don't know.
What is the point of going there? These are the enemy. And
well, they are, but the thing that I don't understand, I mean, that's a really valid question, Yoel, but the next verse, verse 12, I don't get it. They knew of his fame, and then David took these words to heart, and he was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them and pretended madness in their hands, scratched on the doors of the gate and let the saliva fall down on his beard. What's the point of all this? I don't understand. What's going through his mind?
So first of all, answering the question I asked, because you're always trying to jump the gun. I've noticed this. You're always
so.
You have no point, so you're trying to push it.
No, but my point is, I say your question is, why did he go there in the first place? Secondly, why now is he afraid that they know him and he's trying to act like he's a madman? What's going on? I don't get it.
So first of all, answering that question why he went there, there's a few answers that I saw. One of them was that he basically said that maybe no one would recognize him. He just can vanish into become a mercenary somewhere. No one know who he is, but that's a possibility. But obviously they recognize him, and he probably knew that they recognize him. Mm-hmm. Also, he's walking around with Goliath's sword, so it'll be a bit of a doozy if he's trying to blend in. One opinion I saw was that no, he knew that they'll recognize him, but mm-hmm. he said that if he can get in quietly, convince them that he's left Saul, he's not fighting for the Israelite side anymore, just to get away from. And by the way, he actually successfully does this later. When he joins the Philistines,
yes,
you can see that this was probably what he was trying to do.
And they see him as an ally.
And they see him as an ally. So he succeeds the second time. The first time, this is probably what he tried. He tried to infiltrate the Philistine lines, become a soldier there, and then be able to develop some kind of power. Because also he knew that he was fighting for Saul, and he was very, very successful. So he said, maybe it'll work out here as well. And the issue is that it doesn't work out for him, and he's well known. Everyone knows David's that famous man. And so what is one of the ways that you prove it's not really you? You behave in the complete opposite of who you are. So
yeah,
he starts behaving like a madman.
But he's now, not trying to make out that he's not David. He's trying to make out that he's David, and David has gone mad. Isn't that the case?
No, I don't think so. I think that in the beginning, he was telling people, "I'm David, and I'm the famous David, and everything. And I'm mm-hmm. trying to. I want to leave the Israelites. I want to join your ranks." Mm-hmm. And then, to try to say, because remember something, they didn't have television back then. There were no, wanted posters
sure.
or anything.
Sure,
and
sure.
No, you can just infiltrate wherever. And unless you're famous, no one will know who you are. And David sure. was seen on the battlefield, but he was seen by the fighters. He wasn't seen mm-hmm. by the average schmo. Mm-hmm. And most of the people he battled against, most of them he killed. So there's a chance that they didn't really know who he was. And then he said he was David. He was walking around. He showed, prove to me you're David. And he shows Goliath his sword, which was probably mm-hmm. a very famous sword, because everyone saw that Goliath was the famous warrior. And because now that he's in danger, he's trying to prove that he's a madman. And they say, he was just telling everyone he was David. He's not really David. He's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You meet people. There was this guy used to be in the old city called Yochanan, and he used to dress up as King David, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Jerusalem
syndrome.
I actually asked someone who knows his children. They said, it was just a show. But you have people, they run around, they claim they're a certain person, And because and then, you know, we discover they're insane. So this is what he would pull the tactic he was using.
Come on, they're not insane. They've got Jerusalem syndrome, which is a form of insanity.
No. First of all, not all the people which walk around in the old city with robes and stuff like that have Jerusalem syndrome. Some people are just people who think that, you know, maybe dressing in robes is being more real, being, you know, more biblical and everything. Though there's no real commandment anywhere in the Bible to dress up in robes and stuff like that. It doesn't say that anywhere.
No. But wait, okay, so wait. You lived in Jerusalem in the old city for how long?
I live in the old city for on and off about 9 years. Did I meet anyone with Jerusalem syndrome? Yes.
Yes, of course you did.
Quite a few.
Come on, just give us one story. Come on.
There were several of them. Okay, here's one of the sweeter men, one of the sweeter people I met who had Jerusalem syndrome. Yeah. There was this old gentleman from England, well into his 80s. I think he said it was like 86 or 87. Mm-hmm. And he wore only white. Mm-hmm. He wore a white cap. He wore white robes.
He was an Essene.
I don't know if it was an Essene. He was renting an apartment somewhere in the Christian quarter. And he always walked around with his funny cap. And he had a little copper coin on his forehead that he... He bought a type of copper that can actually shine up to make it look gold, and he wrote on it, holy to the Lord. Mm-hmm. And he walked around with this thing. I mean, he was very, very sweet, very, very friendly. It wasn't loony yelling and screaming and everything. I'll tell you about one that was yelling and screaming in a moment. And he would walk around the streets, and he was loony, but he was a bit more down to earth. You know, when he had to do hip surgery, then he actually realized he has to go. He wasn't standing there going like, "Oh Lord, I go, you know, invoke you, heal me," or something. You know, he realized he has to undergo surgery. So he flew back to England to do surgery, and he came back to Israel after the surgery. And I think the funniest thing was that I was working in this place, and we had, maybe some people remember me from there. Was this obnoxious ultra-Orthodox guy. And, we had a set of priestly clothing, and he was very excited to see this because it looked more real to him,
and more authentic.
Mm-hmm. He said the Temple Institute stuff looked a bit, you know, maybe too modern or something. I'm not sure what he meant by that, but he was very excited because he also could walk up very close, and I was even able to open up the box and let him touch it and look at it and everything. So he became my best buddy even when I did that. And he actually came the next day and said that he had a dream that the Lord appeared to him and said that he has to have one of these clothing, like this. The Lord told him to answer a set like this. Mm-hmm. And he asked me, where can I buy one of these? And I said, I don't think you can buy any of them. There were several of these sets made, and the guy who made these hasn't made any in years. And... I don't think he's selling any of them, and especially he won't sell to you. So he said, okay, I'll bring a tailor. So a tailor comes in, he brings this Armenian guy who's a tailor, very good, actually very, very good tailor, by the way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he walks in and he looks at it and he says to him, you know, we're both Christians and we don't both believe in Jesus. And he goes on and on and about their mutual faith just to, you know, get him to listen to what he wants. And he says to him, and the Lord appeared to me and said that I need one of these sets. So the guy looks at me and says to me in Hebrew, how much was this thing? How much is this thing worth? And I said, about $5,000.
Really?
And he smiles and said, that's more or less what I thought it would be. And I said, so what are you going to tell him? We were communicating in Hebrew. And this man standing there was like, well, what are you talking about? He says, oh, he's asking me a few details about the robe, exactly how it was made. You know, he actually asked. He asked questions. Oh, how was it made by hand? Was it with a loom? Was it pieces sewn together? So I had to give him all these details. Mm-hmm. And he turns around to him and says, listen, this is not going to be cheap. And he says, how much is it going to be? You know, the Lord told me, and he says, about $5,000. And he said, I think I have to go back and talk with the Lord about this.
Oh, no. So that's one example of Jerusalem. Give me one more. Come on.
Okay, so there was this one time, there was this lady who, she appeared and disappeared several times. Mm-hmm. And
what, in front of you, or...
No, she would show up walk around the old city for a couple of days.
That would be impressive. Come on.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah. No, she would show up. She would vanish, go somewhere, come back after a while. She would on and off for a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
And she would, at one point, she showed up beginning with a white robe and just stood there.
Mm-hmm.
Then one day she showed up and she had golden little leaf things on the front of her robe. It said something about God appearing or something like that, something in Hebrew. She figured out how to write the verse in Hebrew. She was an American.
Mm-hmm.
And then she started becoming very, very loud and yelling at people. if an Orthodox Jew walked around, "You rejected Christ," and she would scream and yell at people. And one day
whereabouts in the old city?
This was around the Jaffa Gate, and she would scream and yell at people in the middle of the street. Because she was very quiet, and then she started, she started feeling a lot more comfortable in the area. People are not bothering her, so she started yelling at people. Mm. I think there was one day she came with a staff in her hand. She's waving this thing around, and then someone called the police and they arrested her.
Right.
And she vanished for a while. She vanished for a while, and one day I saw her. She was riding a donkey.
Oh, that's right.
She was riding a white donkey.
No,
she found some Arab kid who had a donkey,
had a
and
donkey
she also. She paid him, and he was just helping her. He was holding the reins and just taking her up and down the road next to Jaffa Gate for a couple of hours. And she was going up and down the street, yelling.
No, because some gold leaves. That's some good props. A big staff. That's some pretty good props. But a donkey. We've now entered circus potential here, and that's some good stuff. But I have to admit, I mean, I know we're off the topic, but I have to admit, Yoel, I was kind of disappointed when I came to Israel because I didn't encounter anybody with Jerusalem syndrome.
You came at the wrong time of the year.
Really? It's seasonal?
It's seasonal. It's the season where they come out and fly around in the city. There are plenty of them.
In the summer? Is it more in the summer?
I don't know. For example, there are a whole bunch of them. They show up. They arrive during feasts. For example, you have a lot of really nice people that show up during the feasts. And together with them, sometimes come crazy people as well. But a lot of them have been mocked. A lot of the ones that do cause trouble have been mocked. And there was this one guy I knew who was very, very strange, thought he was a prophet. He came to Israel at one point, and they stopped him in Ben-Gurion and sent him back home.
Mm.
They would interrogate him several times until one time he came with the passport checking.
Mm.
And they said, "Sorry, sir, next plane, you're out of this country." And he never came back again.
Wow. Okay.
So we meet these types. These are people that not necessarily suffer from real insanity. It can be insanity just because they're in the Jerusalem area, but it has to do with their religious inclinations. And as my wife's father says, Jerusalem is a magnet for the religiously strange.
It's a reality, and it has a name. It is Jerusalem syndrome. And for those who don't know what Jerusalem syndrome is, we don't have time to go into it now. But look it up on the internet. It is actually
it's an insanity that's dependent on being in Jerusalem.
That's what it. Very good. That's what it is in a nutshell. Brilliant. That is. That's a good definition. And in any case,
definition. That's how they define it. That's how psychiatrists find the syndrome.
And so David pretends. He pretends to be an insane person to not be recognized. So this is what you're saying, to not be recognized, as opposed to being, "Hi, I'm David, but I'm insane now." He's saying, he's pretending to be someone who's lost the plot as to not be recognized. And then Achish said to his servants, "Guys, come on. What are you bringing before me, this insane man? What, you don't think I have enough insane people to deal with? Why have you brought him to me? I have no need of a madman, that you have brought this fellow to play the fool, play the madman in my presence. Shall this fellow come into my house?" And so he's like, let's move on. This guy's obviously a nutter. Let's forget about him.
But by the way, several things. First of all, there are several possibilities here why he's actually scared. It looks as if he's kind of a bit worried about this nutter. And there are several options why he's a big concern.
Because he's drooling all over his beard. I don't want to go near him.
Would you please wait it with the beard drooling thing? The thing is that insanity in the ancient world was, some people believed it was contagious, a disease.
Good point.
And some people believe that people who were insane were touched by the divine. So also one of the tactics that David did here was that if he runs around thinking people are crazy, it could be one of several things. Oh, it's not really David, the guy's insane. Or that even if it's David, he is behaving in the same way, which means he's been touched by one of the gods. And you know that to touch that such a person. They were protected. Some people with types of insanity, these people were considered to be untouchable. You were not allowed to harm them.
Really?
And that's probably one of the tactics that David was using here. It's not just, getting away with, oh, it's not really David. It could be, though, he's not hiding the fact that he's David. He basically realized that if he plays insane, they believe that people who are insane are prophets of sorts.
Like the unwritten rule, you don't punch someone wearing glasses.
Yeah, well, that explains why I haven't been in fights for a very, very, very long time, doesn't it? No, I'm kidding.
Okay, so he's insane, so let's leave him alone. That's your point.
Yeah, basically, let's leave him alone. It can be different reasons. Again, the text doesn't really tell us exactly what the point was, but it could be either one of the ones I pointed out here.
There it is. Okay, fair enough. I'm going to leave it here. This is where I'm going to leave it. This is the end of chapter 21. Yoel Ben Shlomo, my friend, thank you for coming back on to Truth to You. And just a reminder to the listeners, it is on Facebook, Hebrew in Israel. Hebrew in Israel is the page where you can go to and see what Yoel's been up to, the topics that are discussed there. Engage with the information, like the page, and get involved. Thank you, my friend.
You're welcome. And thank you for having me again. And
always a pleasure having you.
Next time.
You're going to be up north.
I'm going to be up north. And hopefully we'll have better internet and I'll be able to see you on video and stuff like that. Yeah. No, I sometimes have students and they want to, it's easier for a person to interact when they can actually see the teacher. And I don't mind that, but this past year we've had so much issues with phone lines and internet. And, we put it down a phone line. It wasn't strong enough for internet. So I had to go get a net stick. And it's pretty amazing. This is really praise the Almighty. This thing has worked very, very well this past year. Yeah, it's been pretty good.
There's no complaint here. And so, but where you're going is going to be stronger still. And
I hope.
I just want to tell the listeners. Hopefully that's going to be the case. But no, the good news about the fact that you're going to a place that's probably going to have better internet is that finally we're going to see a Hebrew in Israel website. But we will keep listeners up to date in regards to that when that happens. But you're going to be there next week, and that's a wonderful thing.
And I'm going to be all by myself. The kids are going to my in-laws because my wife has to continue working. So I'm going to be away from my wife for almost a month, and away from the kiddos as well. Which means I'm going to have more time actually taking a babysitter.
Not only are you moving, but you're renovating as well. So this is the family home. This is the old family home.
This is the old family home. We're actually almost done. It's a big headache when you renovate, specifically if you're doing it from distance.
Mm.
So I had to take this guy to supervise over them. And we even when we find someone to supervise, there's still issues that we discover. And we've had arguments over the phone. Yesterday we had an argument over one of the toilets. They didn't put it in yet. And I wanted an explanation because he said, oh, we're going to be done by Thursday.
You need that. You need a toilet.
Yeah, there's one. It's supposed to be two. It's very funny. We lived there. We lived there for as six people, but my parents and my other three brothers. We lived there. And we had one toilet. So it was very interesting the routine we had because my dad is like me. We both wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning. So we were fine. I've been waking up at 5:30 in the morning since I was like 14 or something.
Wow.
So I've been sleeping. Not too many hours for a very, very, very long time. And so my dad would wake up half an hour before me, so he would use the toilet, and then I would wake up after him, and I'll have my turn. And then my older brother would wake up much after me. So he had his turn. And then my younger brothers would wake up after everyone, and they would have their turn. So it always worked out. The problem was during Shabbat, when we all more or less woke up at the same time. And there'd be a queue. So one of the decisions I made, it was really funny. My wife was like, she saw me say this and said, "You're very convicted about this." And I said, "Oh yeah, I am." And I said to her, "So when we move in there, we will have at least two toilets. So help God." And my wife was very surprised. And my dad called me up a couple of days ago, and he says to me, "So how are things going?" I said, "We're almost done." He says, "Oh, really? You're almost done. What have you done there?" And I said, "Well, we have a brand new kitchen. We have the entire place repainted. And we redid the bathroom. We retiled everything, did all the piping, renewed all the piping and everything. So in other words, this cost us a lot of money. But I'm very happy we did it." Mm-hmm. And I told him we installed another toilet. And I can hear the complete silence on the other, and he says, "Where?" And I said, "Well, where the shower used to be, what they used to do back in the 1970s, 1980s, where they would make a bath with a shower head as well and a tap and everything, and they would make a shower unit." And I never liked the idea of that shower unit. I said, "What's the point? It's a waste of space. That's, you know, I can shower in the bath." And so I always had this crazy idea that when we renovate the place, I always pushed it. I told my dad, "We have to renovate the house." This was back in the 90s. "Dad, we have to renovate the house. You know, we have to really fix a whole bunch of stuff." My dad never got to, because my parents were poor. We really had money for nothing. So renovating this place is a big therapeutic thing for me, because it's now we're fixing what was wrong back then. And so I have had this idea for years, and I'm the first member of my family to actually do something about it.
Finally. So you're living the dream. Your dream has become a reality. You are now going to be in a house with two toilets and the same amount of people.
Oh, the miracle. But you have to understand something. If you're an American or you live in a European country or something, there's a certain standard. But here in Israel, certain standards that you would find in the United States specifically are not the same standard you would find, here in Israel. For example, I grew up in a room. I had to share my room with one of my brothers. You know, a lot of people that I met said, "Oh, they grew up in their own little room, or they had their own big room of their own." And here in Israel, we were raised to live in a more simpler world, a simpler life. And, we didn't have – I look at my shoes, for example. Just as an example, today I have 5 pairs of shoes. And I feel bad that I have 5 pairs of shoes, because as a kid I had 1 pair. And that was my 1 pair for the year. Okay, so I have 5 pairs of shoes. I have hiking boots now. I have walking shoes. I have sandals. I have a pair of Crocs that my in-laws bought me as a gift. And I have a pair of running shoes. You know, I look at this and I go like, "Wow, this is a completely different world than what I grew up in." So I'm very, very thankful to God for everything that He's done. You know, I have plenty of clothing now, plenty of everything. You know, I got a successful business that's really working out. There's some really nice people also decide to donate some money to help out with material, because you know books are not that cheap, and God willing, when I get enrolled in the bachelor's degree in linguistics, I'll have access to a library. But again, you know, still there's certain things that libraries don't always have. So, you know, some people have sent a little bit of money here and there to support what I do. Mm. I'm very, very thankful. So here's an official thank you on recording to everyone who's donated money to help out. And
thank you. And thank you to the Truth to You. Actually, thank you to the Truth to You listeners that do give back to Yoel for everything that he's given back to us. And just while we're talking about that, Yoel, just let them know that HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com is the email where you can contact Yoel if you would like to contribute back to him for everything that he's given to us. Really do appreciate that.
So it's a big thing, you know. Maybe it's actually very important I have this in recording to say this, that it's we as children, we lived a pretty tough life as kids. Being first of all, very, very surprising, my first language is actually English when I was a child. Now it's Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult because we didn't grow up in Israeli. My parents were not Israelis. And my father, because he's an English speaker and he speaks with a British accent, people always thought that we had money. And this mm-hmm. is why we were treated sometimes very badly by some people in the society.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we reached a point where my parents couldn't pay for anything. So I personally feel this is God turning around and saying, no, you can succeed in my land.
Mm-hmm.
You can be successful here mm-hmm. in this land. Because definitely my family is scattered all over the world. I'm going to be the last of the member of my family who's actually going to be living in Israel. Because everyone's been gone through a lot of trouble or trying to succeed in different places, not really working out. And mm-hmm. you know, I have, for example, younger brothers who I don't even know who they really are because they left the country when they were children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is very, very, very therapeutic, very, very helping to actually move there. So I want to officially thank the Almighty Creator of the Universe for creating this opportunity and really making it happen really fast, because we started renovating about a month and a half ago. So
But before we move on to that, Yoel, just on what you were just saying, you are the last one of your siblings to stay in Israel, but of course, God has blessed you with a wife, a wonderful wife that has given you four boys that are going to stay in Israel, and that too is a wonderful miracle. It reminds me of what is that, Psalm 127? Children are the heritage from Yehovah, the fruit of the womb as a reward, like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are sons of one's youth. Happy is the man who has a quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies at the gate. And there you are.
Speak? No, it's a mistake.
Contend?
No, it means they eradicate the enemies at the gate.
Oh, that's even better.
Yeah, it's a problem with that specific root. They can be the root of to speak, and also can be the root of to disease or eradicate or plague. So
there it is. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. So again, my friend, thank you for coming back on, and I look forward to talking to you once you've moved. I hope the move goes well. I'm sure it will. And next time we speak to you, you will be there, and it is a blessing that you are there and that it's all coming together. It's a wonderful thing. So in the meantime, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom.